KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, we hear from around the world about the global impact of the shutdown of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and find out what a new trade policy could mean for Chinese retailers like Shein and Temu. Plus, in a new novel, young cousins take on a ghostly presence.
I was home in Salem, Massachusetts, and I saw a sign that described New England Gothic as old sins, innocence lost, light dimmed, and nightmares that may be real. And I was like, that is perfect. I'm going to steal that.
It's Sunday, February 9th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Trump administration is defending its use of the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba to house people arrested by immigration authorities. Thousands have been taken into custody since President Trump took office. Some have been released, others taken to private or local detention facilities. The Guantanamo Bay base had been used to hold suspected terrorists after the September 11th attacks. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says it's appropriate for these detainees as well.
The president's comfortable with that, and his legal scholars are. And obviously, there'll be people that will be critics of that. But we are standing up the operations, believing we have all legal right and authority to do so. And that facility has been used for migrants in the past. The direction that they're flowing and the agreements that we have with their home countries will continue to keep that population changing.
Noem was interviewed on CNN. Some religious groups are criticizing the Trump administration for suspending the U.S. refugee resettlement program. NPR's Jason DeRose reports that work is often done by faith-based groups.
Of the 10 U.S. resettlement agencies that work with the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees, the majority are faith-based. They include Catholic, Episcopal, Evangelical, Lutheran, and Jewish groups. Melissa Rogers was head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships under both the Biden and Obama administrations.
The government does a smart thing when it works with these organizations who know how to bring about change in people's life that can be transformational.
Meanwhile, Trump advisor Elon Musk has, without evidence, called federal money going to a group of Lutheran charities illegal. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
The Israeli military has fully withdrawn from a large strip of land bisecting Gaza. The troop withdrawal is part of the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Israeli troops have withdrawn from the Nitzarim corridor in the middle of Gaza that Israel's military occupied as its main base during the war. NPR producer Anas Baba.
This now opens up a new area where Gazans are allowed to return and move freely without the presence of Israeli forces. No traces of the area remain. What was once a paved highway is now a dirt path, and one can see sewage pipes beneath the ground.
Troops razed entire neighborhoods to make way for the corridor. A body was found under a sand dune. Soldiers left ammunition canisters and graffiti. One message reads, Trump Tower, Gaza. Hamas said the withdrawal shows Israel did not achieve total victory over it. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
Egypt says it's calling an emergency meeting of Arab leaders this month on the future of Gaza. This comes in response to President Trump's comments that the U.S. take control of Gaza and the Palestinians are moved out. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Leaders from around the world are gathering in Paris for a summit on artificial intelligence. The two-day meeting begins tomorrow. It's being hosted jointly by French President Emmanuel Macron and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Vice President J.D. Vance will represent the U.S. Along with tech leaders, they'll discuss how to establish rules for AI so that it benefits everyone while containing its risks. Macron says the technology can't be the Wild West. In 2008, someone tweeted, "Superb owl party tonight." And from that, an internet typo took flight. Since then, the typo has given people a space for those who scavenge the web for hashtags, memes, and owl pictures. NPR's Amy Held explains.
In case it flew over your head, Superb Owl is Super Bowl with a misplaced space. Maybe a perfectly placed space for owl lovers. The subreddit Superb Owl was hatched, now with nearly 500,000 members. It's active year-round and really soars around Super Bowl time. And it's not just internet fluff. Owls are threatened by habitat loss and climate change. The Superb Owl meme, experts say, has driven people to learn more about the birds of prey and their incredible features like night vision and full head rotation. This weekend, enthusiasts can even attend Superb Owl parties, scheduled outside game time for those who give a hoot about football, too. Amy Held, NPR News.
The Super Bowl is tonight in New Orleans. Kickoff is 6:30 Eastern Time. The Philadelphia Eagles are taking on the Kansas City Chiefs, who are seeking their third Super Bowl win in a row. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. When President John F. Kennedy set up the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, it was the height of the Cold War. Kennedy envisioned the agency as a critical humanitarian tool and a way of countering the Soviet Union around the world.
The people who are opposed to aid should realize that this is a very powerful source of strength for us. It permits us to exert influence for the maintenance of freedom.
One of the people now opposed is President Trump. Over the years, USAID has faced accusations of inefficiency and waste. It has also helped fund and support humanitarian work in more than 100 countries on behalf of the U.S., the world's largest donor of humanitarian aid. Now that the Trump administration has begun to dismantle the agency and freeze foreign aid, we'll turn to Dia Hadid in Mumbai, Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg, Ada Peralta in Mexico City, and first up, Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv.
Ukraine is the largest recipient of USAID funds. It's received $37 billion in the last 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion. That aid has touched practically every aspect of Ukrainian life, says Oleksandr Mereshko, a member of parliament from President Volodymyr Zelensky's party.
There are lots of programs which are very useful, including support of our war veterans, programs related to health care, a support of parliament,
and paying the salaries of emergency service workers. It's also kept farmers in business, and it's helped rebuild Ukraine's power grid after repeated Russian strikes. Now that the Trump administration is dismantling the agency, the chaos has left many in limbo, including Olena Horyacheva, who runs a medical charity in the southern city of Mykolaiv. She says programs providing treatment for tuberculosis and HIV have shut down for now.
We paid to deliver antiretroviral therapy to HIV patients who could not get to a hospital or see an infectious diseases specialist. We worked with medical institutions so nurses could send out those parcels every month.
The cuts have also hit local Ukrainian media. The news website Sukur in the northeastern city of Sumy relies on USAID funding.
More than 60% of our budget.
Dmytro Tishenko is Sukur's editor.
So now we have a big challenge. We're trying to communicate with our European partners to cover that.
He says Sukur has enough money for just another month. And Sumy, a frontline city frequently attacked by Russia, depends on facts, he says, not unfiltered social media compromised by Russian propaganda.
Mareshko, the lawmaker, says he hopes the Trump administration will revive USAID after reviewing or overhauling it.
It's important not only for Ukraine. I think it's important for the United States. And besides, let's not forget about information war on the part of Russia and China.
He says without USAID, the United States will leave a void that will quickly be filled by Russia and China. I'm Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv.
USAID used to do a lot of heavy lifting in South Asia, as well as in Afghanistan, where there's been an ongoing humanitarian crisis. Now, amid chaos in Washington, the aid agency's education projects are suspended in Afghanistan. That includes secret schools for hundreds of Afghan girls after the Taliban banned them from learning beyond grade six. USAID funded other work to support Afghan women, including a project to train female journalists. That was through a news outlet called Zan Times. The editor, Zahra Nader, tells NPR this project is now on hold.
The notification actually came on the day that we were supposed to start our first online class, and we couldn't dare to tell to this woman journalist who was joining us online from Afghanistan.
Nader says it feels like Afghan women are being abandoned. In Bangladesh, a fairly poor country of about 170 million people, USAID had all sorts of projects, including a popular local version of Sesame Street. USAID last year shared a video of one of the Bangladeshi puppets, Halum the Tiger. USAID also took on quite big public health issues in Bangladesh, like a project to screen and treat tuberculosis patients. An NPR producer, Ahmad Hussein, spoke to a doctor who worked on that project. He requested anonymity. He wasn't allowed to speak to the media, fearing his group will be denied future funding from Washington. He told NPR that Bangladesh likely has about 3.7 million people infected with tuberculosis, or TB. It's a highly contagious bacterial infection that can be deadly. But many Bangladeshis don't know they're infected. So USAID funded a program to teach medics to screen for the illness. That included training around 3,000 pediatricians, because it's often children who aren't diagnosed. USAID was also funding TB centres to treat patients, and the doctor NPR spoke to says more people will be infected as a result, and he says more lives are going to be lost. I'm Dia Hadid in Mumbai.
South Africa has the highest number of people living with HIV in the world, over 8 million by some estimates. In recent years, it's made great inroads with prevention and treatment. And much of that is down to the support of USAID with its funding of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR.
I'm standing on the street in Johannesburg outside the Engage Men's Health Clinic. It's sponsored by PEPFAR, and there's a notice saying, regrettably, our clinic is temporarily closed because the funder has pulled their services.
So I just came today just to do collection of my PrEP medication.
I bump into 30-year-old Alex on the street outside the clinic. He's been coming here for years to collect his pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. We're not sharing his second name for medical privacy reasons. PrEP medication prevents HIV infections in people at high risk.
This place is also catered for LGBT. So a lot of people, they can be, you know, in the closet and they don't want their family to find out. They would come to this clinic.
HIV-positive people in South Africa are bracing themselves for tough times ahead. While the government here provides the antiretroviral drugs, about 17% of its other HIV funding comes from PEPFAR. That's about $440 million a year. The government here says 15,000 healthcare workers stand to lose their jobs.
Where we will see an impact is in areas of prevention.
Professor Salim Abdul Karim, an award-winning epidemiologist, has spent his career fighting HIV in South Africa. He says people can still receive ARVs at government hospitals.
While South Africa is one of the richest countries on the continent, places like Mozambique and Malawi depend almost entirely on PEPFAR.
The entire AIDS pandemic will be under threat in that we could now see a resurgence of AIDS infections because patients are stopping their medication.
He also says HIV research will be hit hard. Several large programs he was involved in have already come to an abrupt halt. Back outside the shuttered clinic, Alex is trying to work out how to get his medicine.
I am devastated that the infection is going to skyrocket. Yeah, it has actually affected us in a great way.
We're now living in fear, he says. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
In Mexico, President Claudia Sheinbaum did not mourn the loss of USAID money. If the U.S., she said, actually wanted to help developed countries, it should be transparent. But USAID has so many parts that the truth is, it's better that they close it down. On the platform X, the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, rejoiced at the news, saying the majority of USAID funds are, quote, funneled into opposition groups, NGOs with political agendas. In Colombia, President Gustavo Petro said the U.S. shouldn't be funding public employees in his country.
Trump tiene razón. Llévese su plata.
Trump is right, Petro said. Take your money. I asked Jake Johnston at the Center for Economic and Policy Research if this surprised him.
Not one bit, no.
Johnston wrote Aid State, a book critical of USAID's role in Haiti, and he says this reaction across Latin America comes because of two main reasons.
These democracy promotion, quote-unquote, things, which are political interventionism in sovereign countries, it is a part of what USAID does.
In both Mexico and El Salvador, for example, USAID has funded investigative journalism outfits that uncovered vast corruption or human rights abuses by the sitting governments. Both countries have bitterly complained that USAID is funding the opposition. The second reason is more complicated. USAID rarely awards money directly to governments.
The USA funding goes almost entirely to contractors, NGOs, or multilateral agencies like the UN.
It means that USAID programs with serious overheads run in parallel to public institutions like hospitals and schools.
And that often runs in direct contradiction to or undermines those public systems.
In Haiti, for example, as USAID pumped free rice into the country, local production couldn't compete and went bankrupt. It means today Haitians import rice from U.S. companies, and this, says Johnston,
it forces people off of their land into either the city to search for low-wage employment or to leave the country altogether and migrate to the United States or elsewhere.
Johnston says USAID has created toxic dependencies and does need an overhaul, but
that's not what's happening here. And instead, you're just going to cause a bunch of people to lose their jobs and a bunch of people to lose life-saving support.
In Haiti, for example, the end of USAID could mean the end of HIV medicine or even life-saving food. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
And we also heard from Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg, Dia Hadid in Mumbai, and Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry announced today it's calling an emergency summit of Arab leaders on February 27th at the request of Palestinians. President Trump has proposed the U.S. take over Gaza and relocate its Palestinian residents. Arab states have rejected that idea. Rescuers in southwestern China are searching for 28 people missing after a landslide yesterday. One person is confirmed dead. And the PlayStation Network says it's now fully recovered after a global outage that began Friday night and lasted about 18 hours. Users could not access online aspects of games such as Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. President Trump's calls for the U.S. to take over Canada, Greenland, the Panama Canal, and even Gaza have many wondering, could this be the return of an old American ambition? As NPR's Scott Newman reports, the president has laid out his vision for the future with a term few of us have heard since high school, manifest destiny.
In the first speech of his second term, President Trump talked about the spirit of America's frontier past, invoking a renewed U.S. expansionism.
Expectations and carries our flag into new and beautiful horizons. And we will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
Trump's mention in the inaugural of Manifest Destiny piqued the interest of Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
It's fascinating to see this term come back because the whole concept of expanding the country, of course, is at the core of the American experience.
O'Hanlon explains that Manifest Destiny was coined in 1845 to describe the belief in America's divine right to occupy the western lands of North America, despite that indigenous people and citizens of other nations already lived there. While most Americans today view Manifest Destiny as indicative of U.S. domestic policy, O'Hanlon argues that in the 19th century, it was central to U.S. foreign policy.
Initially, all these lands in the Ohio Valley, and of course the Louisiana Purchase, and the Great Plains, and the Southwest, which were conquered, taken from Mexico in 1846 to 1848, all of these lands were acquired by the United States when they had not originally been part of the country.
Will Freeman, a fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, sees some parallels between Manifest Destiny and Trump's current vision for the country.
But I do think the context is different. Now it's, I think, about rising geopolitical competition with China, Russia, and others.
Freeman says that the U.S. today is more concerned with strategic choke points and resources. While Trump's remarks might seem geared toward boosting patriotism or energizing his base, the rest of the world is not likely to see things in quite the same way.
It is absolutely setting off alarm bells.
That's Susan D. Page, a former U.S. ambassador during the Obama administration and current professor at the University of Michigan.
I think the question for all of our partners, neighbors, is how serious are these, I wouldn't call them threats, but are the intentions?
Page suggests that Trump's disruptive foreign rhetoric could unsettle both allies and adversaries who would prefer a more conventional diplomatic relationship with the new administration.
If anything is true about foreign policy, national security, diplomacy, people like stability.
Given Trump's unpredictable nature, achieving that stability is likely to prove challenging. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
Big changes are coming to companies selling very cheap things from China, like Shein and Temu. Inside President Trump's new tariffs on China is a plan to end a tax loophole that has helped these companies explode in recent years. NPR business correspondent Alina Selyuk is here to tell us more. Hi, Alina.
Hello, hello.
So tell us about this loophole. How has it worked?
Okay, so whenever a foreign shipment comes into the U.S., it goes through customs, and if it is a big shipment, it gets inspected, and the importer has to pay an import tax. That's a tariff. But for almost a century, U.S. law has carved out an exemption for small packages under a certain value, like $200. And the idea was, like, if you're an American tourist shipping something back home, for example, you shouldn't have to pay an import tax. They even called this loophole de minimis, which is Latin for something trivial, insignificant. Well, over time, this little exemption became huge business because of online shopping.
And that's where Shein and Temu came in.
Shein and Temu and TikTok Shop and Amazon that has many, many Chinese sellers. About a decade ago, Congress expanded the exemption to packages worth under $800. So if you're shipping a box of clothes or kitchenware under $800, it's duty-free. You get faster inspection and skip the tariffs. And these online sellers realized this is a big advantage. Most retailers ship in bulk to U.S. warehouses, so they go through all the customs steps. But Shein and Temu mostly ship directly from their Chinese suppliers to your doorstep here in the U.S., and that's duty-free. It saves them millions of dollars, and that's part of the reason why they're able to charge $10 for a dress or $30 for a dresser. And that is how they went from companies we hadn't heard of to, you know, very popular, growing fast.
So is the exemption going away, meaning every package from China to the U.S. is subject to inspection and tariffs?
That's the idea. So the loophole was supposed to end already, but there was a lot of concern that this rapid change would overwhelm customs. So the Trump administration has pushed back the end date until customs is ready. But I should note, you know, closing the tariff loophole has bipartisan support. President Biden had proposed ending it, saying it undercuts American companies. And a big group of Democrats in Congress had written that foreign importers use this loophole for less strict inspections of packages containing, for example, unsafe toys or even fentanyl and drug processing equipment, which is the argument President Trump is making now.
When the loophole ends, will Shein and Temu have to raise their prices?
Or they might have to change how they run their business. The companies have not commented, by the way, but they do have a few choices, so they can start shipping less directly from China. They could start shipping in bulk to warehouses in the U.S., like a traditional retailer. They might make more stuff in other countries, like Shein has started doing in Brazil and Turkey. Or they might use the common tariff evasion technique, which is to briefly reroute shipments through elsewhere in Asia before shipping to the U.S. Alternatively, they stick to their guns and keep operating as they have, and that means more scrutiny of their packages at customs, more time, and of course, more tariffs.
Whatever they do, it sounds like new costs for them, which brings us back to what I just mentioned, higher prices.
It's not guaranteed that shoppers will end up paying those costs, but typically they do end up paying the tariffs costs, and that would threaten kind of the very reason people choose Shein and Temu. They're ultra cheap. Shoppers tend to make this calculation like, maybe it's not the highest quality, maybe it takes a while to ship, but it is so cheap, it's worth it. And the price going up would change that math.
That's NPR's Alina Selyukh. Alina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To some folks, this is a golden age of TV. And it does sort of feel like there's something on the tube for everyone. But there's also a lot that we're waiting for. The White Lotus comes back next weekend after more than 2 years.
To Thailand and a week of new memories.
A new season of the HBO show The Last of Us will finally come back this spring, also after 2 years.
Oh, you want to start at one?
And who knows when we'll ever get a final season of Stranger Things. It can feel like a lifetime before you get to see your favorite characters again. And that's if the TV gods have announced the show is coming back at all. I mean, the Stranger Things kids aren't even kids anymore, are they? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to tell us why. Welcome.
Hey, I'm still waiting for The Sopranos to come back. So.
Okay.
I'm used to waiting.
Yeah, well, look, this is a complaint I have because I feel like I have to do homework and rewatch shows just to know what's going on by the time the new season airs, and I don't have time to do that. Is it really a very long wait, or does it just feel that way?
No, it's really that long. So just this year, Severance has come back on Apple TV Plus after nearly 3 years away. Stranger Things was expected to return for its fifth and final season in 2025 this year after 2 years away, but it's still kind of unclear exactly when or if that's going to happen. I mean, True Detective came back last year. They were gone for 5 years, and HBO's Euphoria just started shooting its final season, and they've been gone for 3 years. So these shows have complex plots. They have involved storylines. It can be really difficult to remember where the last season ended when you're watching the new season years later.
That's the problem. This isn't like Murder, She Wrote. Like, you really got to know what's going on.
And don't we miss the simplicity? Yes.
Some of this might have to do with the format of streaming, but Hollywood has also had some hiccups that have led to some delays, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we had strikes by both the writers and actors in Hollywood for a lot of 2023 that delayed production on a lot of shows. And the industry was already kind of tied in knots because it had just gotten through the pandemic. And we've had recent wildfires in California that present a whole other gigantic challenge. But I think a big part of these delays also come down to streaming services that wait too long to greenlight new seasons of a show. Also, I think creative issues can kind of tie up a series, which seem to be a problem for Severance. You've got popular movie actors doing TV, so scheduling can be an issue, like Michelle Yeoh's Star Trek movie for Paramount Plus, Section 31. And special effects and post-production can also take a while, and that affects series like Stranger Things.
Are studios taking notice? Because I know I'm not the only one getting tired of waiting. And then sometimes I don't even watch the new season because I'm like, I can't remember the old one.
Yeah, exactly. They are definitely taking notice. I mean, one thing I think we've seen is that the streamers will greenlight a new season of a show shortly after it debuts or even before the current season debuts. And that's a way of shortening the delay. So on Amazon's Prime Video, the third season of their popular action show Reacher was announced before the second season even debuted on the service.
Ever think your brother didn't reach out to the cops because he couldn't reach out to the cops? Maybe he was dirty.
Think real hard before you finish that sentence. It'll determine how well your jaw works the rest of your life.
And it was the same with their other crime action series, Cross, which was picked up for a second season before the show even debuted last November. And Reacher's third season drops next week, so the delay between those seasons is just a little over a year, which is not that bad for streaming. Reacher kind of went from having all its first season episodes drop on one day as a binge model to having episodes released weekly in its second season. And so that creates appointment television where people show up for episodes when they're released, but it also kind of stretches out the amount of time that fans take to watch the current season. So again, it kind of shortens that delay. And they're not the only show that's doing this.
Isn't that kind of an old idea, just like regular old TV?
You make a good point. And I've been covering this stuff long enough to remember how controversial it was in the early 2000s when The Sopranos began to take over a year. One time they took 21 months between seasons.
I'm sitting here like patience on a monument waiting for discipline to be handed down.
But there's a lot going on here. I mean, in the old days of classic television, they made a lot more episodes in a season. They would do more than 20, and they released them once a week. Now, a full season of a series might be 8 episodes, and they might all come out on the same day. So viewers are consuming these episodes faster, which is kind of the downside of being able to watch at your own pace. And it's also why platforms like Netflix are releasing episodes of some popular series in batches. So there's more time for word of mouth to spread, and viewers take a little more time to watch a given season, and the delay between them will be shorter. Now, streamers are always negotiating this tension between giving viewers the shows exactly when they want them and giving the storytellers the time and space to craft their best work, which unfortunately means that some fans like you are going to have to wait an awfully long time to see new episodes of programs they love.
Okay, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. I'm going to let you go. I do have some more episodes that I need to binge before the next Severance episode comes out.
Yeah, I got to finish my email to HBO asking when the new season of Sopranos comes out. So yeah. I'm with you.
Thank you. Later on All Things Considered with Scott Detrow, ever chat with a friend about favorite movies and the one they mention gives you the ick?
Not because it's necessarily gross, but maybe it tries too hard or is too quirky or too preachy or just too much.
For me specifically, it's like movies that people choose clearly because they think that it makes them seem smarter for choosing it and smarter than you.
Now, what movie would raise that red flag? Find out later today by listening to your radio, your phone, or your smart speaker. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. For nearly a month, Democrats in Minnesota's House of Representatives boycotted the state capitol over a power disagreement with the Republicans. The GOP carried on without them, but none of it counted. Now, party leaders have struck a deal bringing Democrats back to the state house. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on how it played out.
For days on end, the Minnesota Capitol felt like that movie Groundhog Day. You know, where Bill Murray keeps living the same day over and over.
A quorum is not present. The House is adjourned until 3:30 p.m. Tuesday, January 28th, 2025.
That's Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. Day after day, he'd come into the chamber, count the members present, and find they're one person short of being able to do business.
The House will adjourn until 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, January 29th, 2025.
This loop all started because voters here elected a tied House of Representatives in November, breaking up full Democratic control of state government. House leaders of the two major parties started to figure out how to share power. That is, until a judge ruled one of the Democratic winners was ineligible to take his seat because he did not properly live in the district he planned to represent. That gave Republicans a one-seat edge, and they decided to ignore the Secretary of State. So Democrats stayed away, keeping Republicans from doing official business.
Hey. Nice to see you guys. Nice to see you guys. What are we making, Play-Doh? Oh, teachers, thank you.
The state's Democratic governor and former vice presidential candidate, Tim Walz, is also spending some time away from the Capitol. He's been popping into places like this Head Start Center to highlight the Trump administration's efforts to reduce federal grants. Walz stayed out of negotiations in the House, but had something to say about it.
This is clearly an opportunity being taken by Republicans to try and seize power for a short period of time. Not in the interest of Minnesotans.
The state Supreme Court stepped in to say what Republicans were doing on the House floor didn't count. Then late last week, House leaders finally struck a deal, and Democrats showed up. Republicans like Representative Jeff Backer were happy to see all their colleagues.
I'm not here to poke them in their eye. We're moving forward now. They're showing up for work. Great. We got a lot of work to do.
The deal gives the Republican leader, Lisa Daymuth, the speakership for 2 years with some conditions on that authority. Republicans agreed to seat a Democratic lawmaker despite questions about his narrow win. And there was a bit of levity the morning of the House reboot when Daymuth was asked if she was going to give the same speech she'd already delivered last month.
Do you want me to? Did you like it? I will have just a short and condensed because I would like to address the entire full body.
Her speech was pretty similar. She says the close tally will give members a unique opportunity to work together. And she gave a subtle nod to being the first woman of color in this role.
The significance of this great honor doesn't escape me. Today is a testament to the progress and the possibilities of our great state.
The state Republican Party still plans to recall some of the Democrats who boycotted. Asked if that concerns her, the leader who lost the speaker's gavel, Democrat Melissa Hortman, says the GOP tactics should also be questioned.
Republicans unconstitutionally and illegitimately seizing power and playing house for 2 weeks is also something that should concern voters.
But with the loop broken, state lawmakers in Minnesota will be making up for lost time as they work to approve a budget this spring. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
This is NPR News.
So, A,
What's your favorite Super Bowl ad?
What's up?
I'm sorry, I was asking you, like, what's your favorite Super Bowl ad?
What's up? The What's Up beer ad.
What's up?
What's up?
Well, that's half the reason people watch the Super Bowl, right? So we'll be recapping this year's best Super Bowl commercials Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israeli officials say Israeli forces have withdrawn from a key corridor in Gaza, which will allow Palestinians to return to their homes. This is part of Israel's commitments under the ceasefire agreement reached with Hamas. Ecuador is holding a presidential election today. There are 16 candidates, including the incumbent. All of them are promising to do more to reduce crime. And it's Super Bowl Sunday. The Philadelphia Eagles are challenging the Kansas City Chiefs, who are seeking their third consecutive win. Kickoff is 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. For many people of faith, caring for their neighbor is an important religious practice. But who is my neighbor? It's a question as old as the Bible, and one being asked again as the Trump administration challenges faith-based groups' work with immigrants and refugees. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose has been looking into this. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So first, let's step back. Like, what's different about the way this administration is talking about faith-based work?
Well, for many years, Republicans, along with Democrats, have promoted the idea that faith groups were well situated to do certain kinds of charitable work. They had close ties to communities and support systems needed to do things like resettle refugees or help, say, teach English to immigrants. This has been framed religiously as caring for the stranger, which is a biblical imperative. You know, in the story of the Good Samaritan, Jesus famously makes the point that a neighbor is someone who shows mercy to a stranger in need. But something Vice President J.D. Vance said recently caught my ear because it represents a different approach. Here he is talking on Fox News.
There's this old school, and I think it's a very Christian concept, by the way, that you love your family, and then you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in your own country. And then after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world.
So what Vance is describing is less caring for the stranger and more caring for those you already know. While he describes it as Christian, many religious leaders have said it isn't especially biblical.
And Elon Musk, an advisor to President Donald Trump, called the charity work of one faith group illegal. What's going on there?
Well, it started when retired Army General Michael Flynn posted on social media a list of Lutheran groups that receive federal money to carry out various social service activities. Flynn called this money laundering, which is a federal crime. Then Elon Musk reposted the message, adding without evidence that these payments were illegal. It's important to say here, Aisha, that these groups have been working with the government for decades and have never been charged with misusing funds. Here's what presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Elizabeth Eaton, had to say.
These organizations have done the same work for 85 years in serving legally admitted refugees and immigrants. As church, we follow the eighth commandment of the scriptures, which states, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor."
And Bishop Eaton holds that the stranger should be considered a neighbor and cared for.
What have the administration's actions meant for faith groups that work with refugees?
Well, the suspension of the refugee resettlement program has meant that organizations that do this work, most of which are faith-based, are now furloughing employees. As for the refugees who are already here, the Trump administration says it won't keep its financial commitment to pay for 90 days of rent, food, and other basic needs. So, faith-based groups that resettle refugees, such as World Relief and Church World Service, are scrambling to raise millions of dollars to care for refugees anyway.
Where did the notion of government helping faith-based charities do their work come from?
Well, faith-based groups that run official charities have long been eligible to apply for government funds to carry out all sorts of work, including feeding poor people and resettling refugees, as long as they didn't use the money to proselytize. Then, during the presidency of George W. Bush, he gave that idea a big boost when he created an office in the White House in 2001 to make it easier for faith groups to get government funds to carry out this work.
I do remember that, faith-based and community initiatives under George W. Bush. Getting back to that biblical idea of who is our neighbor, how might that question continue to affect the mission of these groups?
Well, now, there's always going to be some tension between the government's way of wanting to run a program and the way a faith-based group wants to run it because they have different priorities. For instance, financial efficiency versus biblical mandate. Stanley Carlson Teese worked with that White House office I mentioned during both the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. He's now with the Center for Public Justice. Here's what he says about just shutting down programs.
I think we have to be very careful, though, in our imperfect world to think that I can't assist my neighbor until all these other things are perfect, partly because they're never going to be perfect. When Jesus talked about loving our neighbor, he didn't say, yeah, go ahead and do that once your family has $1 million in the bank.
And Aisha, a question that I'll be keeping my eye on is how people of faith who've supported Donald Trump respond to these policies, since it does represent a significant shift in what had been longstanding Republican support for faith-based groups getting this kind of funds to care for their neighbors.
That's NPR's Jason DeRose. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Do you remember as a kid those long summer days just running around wild with other kids while the adults were off having adult conversations? In Christelle Bamford's new novel, Idle Grounds, a family has gathered for a summer birthday, and the young cousins are soon to be set loose. Here she is reading from the first pages of her book.
We were all together, which everyone seemed to dread and anticipate in equal measure. Cousins stuck their legs out from car doors, always the children first, parents girding their loins behind the steering wheels. It's 11 now, we're out of here by 3, our parents said, a fount of shaky determination. 3 at the latest. Cousins eyed up cousins, standing a full cousin length away, giving a shy wave while the adults eased themselves out with a dish covered in tinfoil or a six-pack of Beck's tinkling like a piggy bank. Bug spray was passed along, hot dogs were sliced from their packaging. Hummingbirds appeared at the feeder, fed, vanished.
In the novel, the day takes a turn when the smallest cousin disappears and the children come face to face with some grown-up truths. Idle Grounds is written by Christelle Bamford, who joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
This story, which I really, really enjoyed, it's filled with a kind of magical, spooky, hazy quality that I think is really specific to childhood because it's like anything can happen. You're a little bit scared, but you're also a little bit excited. Do you know that feeling?
I remember that feeling really well from childhood. I think my memory isn't very good as an adult, but it's great for when I was a kid. The book is based in part on my own childhood in New England, just kind of running around in the woods and making forts and coming home just in time for dinner. And I loved it. And I loved that sense of kind of making and remaking like a child society every day with your pals.
And what is it like for the specific kids in this book? They're only about 20 feet away from the house, but they are like in their own world completely.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that the world of Idle Ground starts to get sinister. So because it's told by this group of kids, you're not entirely sure if it's their imagination at work or if there is something genuinely sinister kind of stalking them across the grounds. And I think a little bit of the book is fitting into a New England Gothic mode. And that's very recent. I actually just was home in Salem, Massachusetts, and I saw a sign that described New England Gothic as old sins, innocence lost, light dimmed, and nightmares that may be real. And I was like, that is perfect. I'm going to steal that. Like, that's exactly right. Basically, Idle Grounds takes place completely in the daytime, but New England Gothic really deals with the fact that there's always a darkness bubbling underneath that kind of daylit adult world. That's kind of how the story unfolds, is they're uncovering this mystery of their family's unhappiness. Basically, it's what the parents are all distracted by talking out on the deck.
I asked you about this before we even started really recording, because this is because as I was reading this book, I was like, who is the narrator? Because the narrator is never named. Is it one of the children or is it the whole of the group? Because the way they talk, I'm like, who is the narrator?
In a way, it's both. So at first, you think it might just be a single child, and then it slides into kind of a Greek chorus voice. I really liked the fact that this narrator knows a lot and also understands nothing most of the time. I think that is really reflective of the way kids experience reality. They're really intuitive and they can really read the room, they can read emotions, and at the same time they're operating with like a really limited instruction manual. So they have like lots of feelings and very few facts. This group voice was able to kind of encompass that.
Now, we are introduced to a few of them by name. Tell us about Abby and Travis and Autumn and Owen. Why are they named?
Yeah, so at the very beginning of the book, Abby and Travis are the golden children of the family. So Travis is the eldest child, which is always obviously a very revered position in child society. And he goes to a very fancy private school, and he's kind of like the bearer of the family's ambitions. And his little sister, Abby, is the youngest of the tribe, and she's just adorable. And then Autumn and Owen, they're almost kind of perceived to be like weaker members of this child society. But as the story progresses, we realize that they have their own inner resources that powers the group as it goes along and keeps them, or at least tries to keep them, on the right course.
Owen finds these eggs, these chicken eggs, and he kind of adopts them and he becomes the parent. What's going on there?
Yeah, I love the eggs. They're maybe my favorite thing in the book. Hopefully the reader should be very nervous for those eggs and hope that at least one of them makes it through intact.
Yeah, very nervous about those eggs. And I should say, my youngest daughter heard me talking about, you know, Owen and the eggs. And this little girl went to the fridge and she got one of the eggs out the fridge saying she wanted to have some eggs. And I said, you know how expensive eggs are? This is very real. Children are fascinated by these eggs.
Yeah, it's true. I think it might have come from a little boy that we know. He'd stolen an egg from the kitchen and hid it out in the grass, and they found it after it started to smell, and he'd just gotten his wires crossed and he was trying to grow a new baby cousin. And I just thought there was something really lovely about that. And so I think for Owen, parenting the eggs is a way for him to strengthen himself. He becomes their protector. The book calls him the mother of these eggs, but he could equally be the father of these eggs.
I guess when you look at that, the children kind of taking on the adult roles, how do you look at this, or what this story is trying to say about childhood, what it's trying to say about what it means to grow up?
Yeah, I think the book thinks a lot about the dangers of nostalgia, of getting too caught up in sadnesses of the past to the point where it warps your present. And kids are really attuned to that. So I think kids are very good at picking up on their parents' unhappiness. And I think parents often forget that their kids are listening and are absorbing, and often absorbing with very little ability to interpret what they're absorbing. So I think that's what it looks at overall, that kind of dynamic.
That's Christelle Bamford. Her new novel is Idle Grounds. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Aisha.
A final note or notes this hour. This is Bach's Partita number 1 in B minor. One of violinist Joshua Brown's favorite pieces of music. And as you can hear, he plays it very well.
I've been playing since I was 2 years old, and now I play for my career.
A career that's blossomed in part due to a renowned type of violin coveted for its sound.
A kind of sound they produce that is not matched by any other kind of instrument. It's maybe a certain depth or sparkle or sweetness to the sound.
When Joshua Brown was 16, he got the opportunity to take home a Stradivarius. Stradivari were made in the 17th and 18th centuries in Cremona, Italy. Let me give you an idea of how valuable they are. $11.2 million. That's how much one went for at auction last week. And over the centuries, there's no telling who might have held these instruments.
I'd like to think that all the people who have played it throughout the years contribute in a way.
Now 25, Brown says the time playing a Stradivarius changed him and his approach to making music. And it would have been impossible without some crucial help.
My name is Paige Bendishon, and I'm the executive director of the Stradivarius Society of Chicago.
I'm Gabriel Bendishon, and jointly with Paige, owner and sponsor of the Stradivarius Society.
The Bendishons match private owners of Stradivari and other 17th and 18th century violins to musicians who show great promise, like Joshua Brown, Midori Goto, and Sarah Chang.
These are not short-term loans. These are loans that go on for years.
The Stradivari Society was started in the 1980s and now has more than 40 instruments in its program.
The instrument becomes an extension of their soul.
And that connection extends through both time and space. As Joshua Brown says, not only does he get to feel connected to the violinists who played before him, but he gets to connect all of them and himself to his audience.
Maybe someone will come to me after a concert and say, I cried during the concert. I think to have a form of art that can provoke such a strong reaction is really important.
And for Paige and Gabriel Bendishon of the Stradivari Society, that's music to their ears, too. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Have a great weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.